Football Weekly with Ken Early. With 14 teams in the last eight, this season's FA Cup is a gift that keeps on giving. Chelsea's owner has cut a lonely figure of late, but the heartwarming events at Vicarage Road proved Roman is an island. Watford were strutting arrogantly into the quarterfinal until the crisis-stricken Blues hit back with a glorious late show. Who's laughing now? There was an intriguing match at Fratton Park between two of the season's soap opera sides. Might Manchester City be discovering that, whatever the question, Craig Bellamy is not the answer? We'll have Sid Lowe on the weekend's action in Spain and the latest choleric ramblings of Rafael Benitez. There'll also be the latest classic installment of the Old Firm rivalry, a roundup of Serie A and the Bundesliga in today's Football Weekly. Hello, everyone. This is Ken Early sitting in for James Richardson. James is on a ski stop today, I believe. Barry Glendenning is at home rumbling through the Iraqi desert in a lightly armoured Humvee in the form of the Generation Kill box set. I believe he's watching. With me, we've got Paul Doyle of The Guardian.
Hello.
We've got Raphael Honigstein of the Süddeutsche Zeitung.
Hi.
And we've got Kevin McCarra, the chief football writer of The Guardian.
Hi, Ken.
Well, I guess we're going to start today with the aforementioned heartwarming match at Vicarage Road.
So, but I have to ask you something.
Yeah?
Ken, is it true you got your job as caretaker anchorman with your solicitor phoning up Sean Ingle and officially putting your name down, and you asked all sorts of questions about what you're going to get and whether you're going to get a little T-shirt with your initials for this? And
the I don't know. My people spoke to their people, and we were able to work out a solution. We're going to have to start at Vicarage Road, where Chelsea had this glorious come from behind victory. Nicolas Anelka, it says today, poured more scorn on Philippe Scolari in his post-match comments. Kevin, I wonder if you, how scornful do you think Anelka's comments actually are? Anelka was saying that he believes Didier Drogba and himself can actually play together.
Well, the odd times they've been in the pitch together, Anelka's tended to play out wide. But also, they just don't seem to link up. I think the stats show they never pass to each other, for example. And a lot of managers, of course, don't even like two forwards anymore. They want one outright and maybe three behind or whatever. So I don't think Scolari is that unusual. I find Anelka a bit irritating, and Didier Drogba massively irritating. When you think of the money Drogba earns at Chelsea, conservatively £80,000 a week, and yet he looks permanently unhappy as if somebody's performed a terrible slight on him that he has to play for Chelsea. You know, it's his performance at Old Trafford this season is my unforgettable moment of the campaign. Mm. 90 minutes of complete nothing. And I think complaining about managers when you've given as little. Anelka has scored some goals, I agree, but also he's had games he just doesn't register. He and Drogba have been a huge problem for Chelsea this season.
It seemed to me that Scolari, the main problem he had with playing the two of them together was that he didn't have the midfielders to play two strikers.
To be fair, I mean, Anelka is the leading goal scorer in the Premier League, and he stopped scoring when Drogba came back and he was shoved out to the right. So I can understand where he's coming from. Whether it's a good thing to criticise the match after, especially after he's gone kick it down when he's a dog when he's down, etc., is a different thing. But I think on the basis of it, I can see his point. Whether they can play together or not, I think, as you said, the more pertinent question is whether they have the midfield that can play actually with four across, because that's always been the problem. That's when everything fell apart, was in the third season when Mourinho tried all sorts of formations to fit in four midfielders. He had permanently four holding midfielders playing in some sort of diamond system with sometimes Ballack at the top, sometimes Essien holding, sometimes Lampard holding. It never really worked. And I think Scolari looked at the squad and think he won't, you know, that's not his formation either. So that is, I think that is the more endemic problem in this squad.
Well, he inherited problems too, didn't he? Because like Malouda is completely ineffective in the left. So that's one option
gone. What happened to him?
Paul, a good player for Lyon. And then, well,
you follow quite a lot of French football. What happened to Malouda?
I don't know what happened to him. I don't know why he hasn't performed as I certainly expected he would. He's traditionally been a slow starter or whatever club he's gone to, but this is taking it to new extremes.
Give him a few more years, he'll come good.
By the end of his contract, he might have...
He'll be up and running, yeah.
No, but really, that is a big mystery, because when he was at Lyon in that season before Chelsea bought him, he was actually keeping Franck Ribéry from his natural position in the French squad on the left, and Ribéry had play on the right. because Malouda was so unassailable.
To me, Anelka does epitomise a tremendous culture of vanity. You hear players saying, well, we weren't fit enough. They'd never think of maybe doing a bit of extra work themselves if they weren't fit enough. No, apparently Scolari is personally responsible for everything and they're responsible for nothing.
Yeah.
And that's what you feel about Chelsea players. I mean, John Terry was very clearly very angry last week speaking in Seville about the Chelsea squad. He says, well, about three of us supported Scolari.
Yeah.
It's outrageous considering what the fans pay to watch it and what the players earn at Chelsea.
I in a way think that it's quite responsible for players to go to the manager and to go to the board and say, look, the training is rubbish. Because I think my guess is most Premier League players would actually say it's great. Training is rubbish. So my take is a little different. And I think you cannot expect players who play three times a week and have, you know, maybe three or four effective training sessions in a fortnight to organise their own fitness regime. It's just not feasible. I mean, they can go jog, but that's not going to cut it.
I'm not sure about fitness at this point in the season. Most players are kind of carrying knocks and limping along. Capello was complaining last week about the difference between November and February in terms of the condition of the players. I don't really believe that Chelsea players are that unfit. I think it's excuses.
Two managers getting a lot of credit lately are Martin O'Neill and David Moyes. David Moyes triumphant at Goodison Park. I was interested in some quotes from Phil Neville before this game, where he was praising his manager at Everton. He seemed to be attempting to hawk him round to bigger clubs. It's pretty ignorant that when the top jobs come round, like the Chelsea job now, these two don't get mentioned. He was referring there to O'Neill and Moyes.
Yeah.
What do you make of it, Kevin? I mean, there seems to be growing consensus there that David Moyes is hamstrung by the lack of funds at Everton. If only he had a huge amount of money to spend, he could really make a difference in the world.
I mean, after the last round, I think I brought a piece talking about Moyes and saying that Alex Ferguson got the Man U job in 86, 3 years after winning the Cup Winners' Cup. Nowadays, Alex Ferguson wouldn't get that job. That wouldn't be deemed good enough. And the standard set to give a job at a top club to a rising manager is almost impossible to meet. They want to employ from a tiny group of players, or a group of managers and Mourinho's and people of that nature. I think David Moyes does deserve a chance. He can do no more than this. I mean, even when he spent $15 million on Fellaini, he recouped most of it because he'd sold Andy Johnson. He's got to balance books. He has no option. The only thing is, David Moyes plays in a fairly pragmatic way, and he can say, well, I have no option. These are the players I've got. Whether he could produce a football team that would delight the Old Trafford crowd, well, we don't know, because he's never been in that situation to attempt that kind of football.
Well, if we look through the rest of the fixtures in the FA Cup, we didn't get too many results. Swansea getting a lot of props for the quality of football they're playing. Some of the reports today claiming that Swansea are playing the best football that you can see anywhere outside the Premier League.
Those who did said they were really impressed by Swansea, and it was a level of football you wouldn't expect from a lower division.
It begs the question, though. I mean, the manager is Martinez is getting a lot of credit here, but if it's possible for Swansea to do that, why is this not? Why do we not see this happening more often at lower league sides?
I think it's fear, isn't it? They all think pragmatism is the obvious way ahead here. Not many are ready to try an idealistic approach. Even if you don't have great players, you can always try and play in an adventurous way that's attractive to watch.
It's very simple. It's just a lot more difficult to play football, because if you pass the ball 20 times, there's 20 times you can make a mistake for the things to break down. If you just knock it up to the big men up front, if it goes wrong, you try again and the ball comes back immediately afterwards.
Just one big mistake instead of 20.
No, it's not a big problem, because you can just do it again and again and again and again. But if you play like Spain, or if you play a bit more possession type football, it's a lot more difficult to do.
But if you hit the big man, you often get into a rut and end up being relegated, don't you? I mean, all kinds of bad teams that lose every week play a pragmatic game. You know, it doesn't work all that effectively. So.
West Ham got a draw against Middlesbrough. What have you noticed about the changes in West Ham's play? Since I mean, evidently the results have improved. We know that, and Steve Clarke is a guy who has already been mentioned, I think, as having done a lot of good work with them. But is there a Gianfranco Zola style becoming apparent in West Ham?
I think it's too early to say that. I mean, when I've seen them, they haven't exactly been playing free flowing, wonderful attacking football. I mean, you could see that they work as a unit, they defend as a unit, they try to go forward as a unit. I mean, I saw them at the Emirates where they were fairly negative, but very well organised, and it was clear that that they had a strategy and that they had a system, and they made it work, and that was very evident. And the fitness levels, as Paul said, they you could see that they were really sharp, and sharper than some of the Arsenal players.
I was intrigued to see that Zola works with the defence and Steve Clark takes the attack. That was interesting. I suppose a former forward might be a good man to analyse how the defence is doing.
Right, that's about it for the FA Cup. Coming up in part two, we're going to talk about the only Premiership game of the weekend, and we're going to talk to Sid Lowe, who's going to be on the phone from Gijón in Spain.
Football Weekly with Ken Early on Guardian.co.uk.
There was, of course, a game in the Premier League this weekend. It was between Portsmouth and Manchester City. Paul, you were at this game. Now, this is an interesting one, I think, for so many different reasons. Let's start, first of all, with Manchester City. Can you explain exactly how it is that this City side is lining out since Bellamy has come in? He seems like the wrong player to have signed.
Well, their formation is pretty clear. It's a 4-2-3-1 with Bellamy being the lone front man up against Stoke, which I also saw and was their last away match before Portsmouth. They basically didn't pass him the ball, and Hughes regretted afterwards that there was a reluctance to put the ball into the box. And that was what the January transfer window was still open, and he was still trying to get Roque Santa Cruz, who would have been a more obvious target man. Mm-hmm. He didn't get him. He seems to put all his eggs in one basket there. Didn't get him, and so he still doesn't have a big man up the front. So now on Saturday he was explaining after the match that the game plan was to try and thread neat balls through to Bellamy's feet, because there was no point in getting it to his head. They failed miserably to do that.
Yeah.
Robinho and Alano didn't appear to have been told about this plan. particularly Robinho. He couldn't get into the game, and he didn't make a huge amount of effort to do so. Alano got on the ball a little more often, but he kept going for the easy high ball, which was meat and drink, meat and drink to Sol Campbell and Distan, who played very deep so that they couldn't knock balls over the top for Bellamy to run onto. Also in that formation, the two in the 4-2-3-1 are Zabaleta and De Jong, and I'm not convinced they actually have the passing ability to serve as the connector. None of them are Carrick, Alonso, or Fabregas, or that sort of player. In the back four, there's real hesitancy.
Really?
Michael Richards, he got injured just before the game, actually, so he couldn't play, so they brought in a young guy. And it's such a terrible defence for a young guy to come in and make his debut in, because the players who are there ahead of him are really hesitant. The offside efforts were a mess, that none of them were in tune with each other, and they were just really, really hesitant. And they're a team who look, the pressure of expectation on them appears to be weighing very heavily. You almost think that they could do with a Harry Redknapp style manager to go in and just tell them that at least in the short term, to go in and just give them a bit of confidence, because they're not playing with a great deal of confidence or desire.
Do you get the sense that they are actually playing for Mark Hughes at all? Because, I mean, I must say that doesn't leap out at me when I see Robinho playing for Manchester City.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I've only seen him away this season. So, and at home, apparently, it's a totally other face that we see for some reason. But away, no. There's nothing there. And you wonder if Hughes is the right man. The only thing working in his favour at the moment probably is that the sort of targets that you'd imagine the owners would be going for are still involved in the Champions League. So he has another few games to try to get it right. But if things go on as they're going at the moment, you'd imagine they'd probably replace him in the summer.
Santa Cruz obviously scored a great goal again in the weekend. But what's your feeling about it, Kevin, just in terms of the patience they're likely to have with Mark Hughes? Because the other thing working in his favour, I suppose, is that he did leave quite an impressive body of work at Blackburn.
Mm-hmm.
Question really is, I suppose, how much of an impression did that make in Abu Dhabi?
Well, it's almost like what you were saying a moment ago about David Moyes
at
Everton, and we don't know whether, if given superior resources, he'd be able to make the step up. At the moment, Hughes is trying to, and it's not working for him.
It's a huge disappointment, because I think we all thought Mark Hughes was going to be an exciting young manager who would stimulate the Premiership, and instead we've got this failure. I don't think it will last. I just don't see people with the kind of money Man City have behind them regarding this as satisfactory. It's not as if he doesn't have players who can do better.
Portsmouth, of course, they're looking for a manager at the moment, but should they be looking for a manager? Is Paul Hart the man in your view, Paul?
Well, they were certainly much improved than under Tony Adams, and if we can believe what David James was saying about Tony Adams, and he talked at length about that regime on Friday, and words like bizarre, ludicrous, and slightly outlandish were mentioned.
James called Adams bizarre and ludicrous.
He never once referred to Adams by name in his half an hour soliloquy.
But really?
He did talk about how events under the previous regime he mentioned bad team selection, muddled tactics, and a complete lack of communication, which sounds like a failure at every level, really. And Paul Hart, and similarly after the game, David James was full of praise for Brian Kidd in particular, saying that you know the training was taken to another level, and that they'd only worked with him for a day, and Paul Hart as well. However, Pompey pressed really high up the park, tackling, even Nico Kranjčar was getting stuck in and things like that. And so it was a much improved performance. But given what Man City served up, that was probably their easiest fixture of the season. And next week against Stoke, I think they're playing will be very different. So, but they have the players there. They shouldn't be in relegation trouble. I don't imagine them going down.
Rafael, you want to come in?
Yeah, well, I think sadly Portsmouth are in a situation where they actually need to bring in some sort of name, not necessarily for footballing reason, but because they're so desperately trying to offload the club. And as soon as you have some sort of name in, it's obviously a lot more easier to then go and say, you know, we've got this guy, here's the manager, we are really going places, can we have your 100 million or even £1 and you take our debt? And I think that might also be sadly one of the reasons why, you know, when we read about new appointments, etc., it's the same list of names, because not necessarily because the financial impetus or the financial prepositions of getting big names in is increasingly becoming a big factor.
It's quite incoherent, the strategy, because I agree with you, they probably do want a big name now to bring some glamour, but the last thing they wanted was a cheap appointment in Tony Adams. So that didn't fit in with the idea of selling the club and making it attractive. So the chant of they don't know what they're doing seems to come to mind here.
James mentioned also on Friday that the calibre of manager, the repute of a manager, has a big input in terms of the calibre of player you can attract to the club. So Eriksen is still highly regarded, and more so than Paul Hart, for example. So probably when it comes to luring overseas players, although I don't know how much money they have to lure overseas players now.
Is Eriksen more highly regarded than Avram Grant, who lured Nicholas Anelka to Chelsea?
I'm led to believe Avram Grant isn't particularly highly regarded by Portsmouth players.
No, they know him, of course.
They know him from his previous time there, and although he didn't have a huge input into training, apparently it wasn't awfully impressive. David James who said that, I should point out.
Okay, well, that about wraps that up for the Premier League. If you do want to know more about any of these stories, make sure you visit guardian.co.uk/football. Now we're going to talk Spanish football with Sid Lowe. Hey, Sid, how you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Very good, very good. But Sid, it's good to hear from you today. I believe you were at Gijón last night to see Raúl score yet more goals for Real Madrid.
Yeah, well, it's two more for Raúl, which means, of course, he's no longer the joint top scorer of all time for Real Madrid with Alfredo Di Stéfano. He's now out in front with 309, one of which was a kind of a typical Raúl goal, really just a nudge in. But the other was a really, really nice finish. And the amazing thing was not that Real Madrid won, because, of course, this is the eighth on the trot, but they were actually worth watching last night. They were really very, very impressive indeed. Although that said, Sporting Gijón kind of made things a little easy for them.
Yeah, I mean, they're a team that has conceded, you know, six or seven goals on occasion this season. So what was so impressive about Madrid?
Well, as much as anything else, I think what was particularly impressive was the tactical awareness that was shown by Juan de Ramos, the variety that he showed to the way he can approach games. Because Real Madrid went into this game thinking, hang on a minute, this could be a real problem for us. Robin was out, Schneider was out, Guti hadn't yet come back to full fitness. And Juan de Ramos, this coach, of course, who during the winter transfer window was insisting that Real Madrid needed a right-sided midfielder. Well, the club bought him Julien Faubert, and I'm sure I won't be surprising many West Ham fans when I say they bought Faubert, and yet Ramos doesn't look keen on him. Last night he played what was a weird kind of hybrid between 4-4-2, 4-3-3, and maybe even 3-5-2. He had Sergio Ramos pushed up on the right-hand side as an attacking fullback. He had Marcelo pushed up on the left-hand side as an attacking fullback, and it really worked. And I think what we're seeing bit by bit with Juan de Ramos is an ability to tinker, an ability to get the best out of the side. And it was genuinely impressive, Real Madrid. But then, as you rightly say, Sporting Gijón have conceded more goals than anyone else this season. And although they've recovered to some extent, they're still a side that are really all or nothing. This is a team that hasn't drawn all season.
Sid, what is Ramos' position as far as the summer is concerned? Does he have a genuine chance of being there come summer, or is it all dependent on election results? I mean, what is the situation for him personally?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, there are so many variables in this, and that's what makes it very, very difficult to call. Obviously, if Ramos was to find himself in a position where he does genuinely push Barcelona even remotely close in the league, and maybe, let's say, get to semi-finals of the Champions League, or possibly even beyond, because if all their players are fit, it wouldn't be by any means impossible for Real Madrid to win the Champions League, then I think he may well find himself in a position in which it's very, very difficult for anyone not to continue with him. But as you rightly say, summer presidential elections, a lot of the presidential candidates are going to come to the elections, not just with star players under their arms, but star managers under their arms. So I think Juan de Ramos probably won't be here next season, but he's doing a very, very good job at the moment of putting himself in a position where it's harder and harder for people to sack him.
Sid, I want to get to another story you brought us this morning, but first of all, just a word on Barcelona. They only drew 2-2 against Betis on Saturday. The wheels coming off?
It's brilliant, isn't it? Barcelona have now dropped a couple of points for the first time in 10 matches. They were 2-0 down, and they did look a little bit ropey, and then they absolutely battered Betis, came back 2-2, and probably should even have won it. And of course, the wheels are coming off. That is what they're saying in Madrid. They're saying now that there's a hope of the league. Barcelona are just 10 points behind now. The league has been thrown wide open again. Now, of course, it hasn't been thrown wide open, but by the same token, you can understand, certainly given what happened a couple of years ago under Fabio Capello, when Real Madrid really hauled them back and it looked very difficult to do so, you can understand why they are getting a little bit excited. But I still think Barcelona look far, far too strong for everyone else. Bear in mind, at the weekend, they started without Messi and Henri because it had been midweek internationals. It's the third time now following international games that Barcelona have dropped points. So they'd be entitled to say, look, this is just a typical blip that we're going to have. From next week on, we'll start winning again. I think Barcelona is a city and it's a club that does have a tendency to get a little bit nervous a little bit quickly. And in Madrid, they're certainly playing on that. And for example, there's this invention that's been bought up by the Madrid press, which describes Barcelona as having a crapping yourselfometer, and they believe that the second that Barcelona lose a couple of games and Madrid win a couple of other games, this crapping yourselfometer kicks into gear and everyone goes, oh my God, they're going to panic. But right now it's 10 points and they're still the best side in Spain by quite a long way.
That's an elegant touch from the Madrid press.
Lovely, isn't it?
But Rafael Benitez said, I was wondering when I read your story today whether Rafa had been at the cooking, Sherry, maybe, when he gave this interview, because there's some fantastic quotes in here. Continuing on, he seems to still be in the quite bad mood that he spent most of January in. Some of his quotes today are, Alex Ferguson controls everything in England. The facts are the facts. He says, in the 5 years I've been here, I've spent less than £40 million on Torres and Keane. Manchester United make £65 million a season more than we do. €65 million, I should say, more than we do. And buy three £20 million players a season. Rafa is playing fairly fast and loose with the facts here. I mean, it's obvious to everyone, really. But I was wondering, what was the context of these statements?
Well, the context of these statements were an interview with a Spanish newspaper in which it's a series of interviews they're doing with Spaniards abroad. So it was a broad interview in which he dealt with a number of subjects. But there is the real context, of course, isn't so much that particular interview. The real context is his ongoing battle with Liverpool, his ongoing battle with Rick Parry, and his ongoing sense of bitterness at the fact that everybody now demands a league title that he thinks Liverpool fans shouldn't be demanding because he hasn't got the resources of other clubs. Now, of course, that part of it is true. They don't quite have the resources of a Manchester United or possibly even a Chelsea, despite the fact that Chelsea have stopped spending money to the same extent. But yeah, Rafa Benitez's remark that he's only bought Torres and Keane was a strange one. And I don't know if Rafa was mixing himself up a little bit there and he was trying to point out that those are the only two big name signings. But of course, that overlooks the £7 million spent on players like Dossena. So it is a strange one. I think that Rafa feels very much like he's been questioned all the time. He's a manager who's extremely sure of himself, even when he's not sure of himself. I think he's always very, very determined, perhaps too determined, to prove that he's right all the time and to challenge anyone who thinks he's not. And that really is the context in all of this. And it's a difficult situation. And And it was interesting that Rafa sort of used the interview to appeal for new contracts for his backroom staff, which on the face of it looks altruistic. But of course, what it really means is get my people in, keep them there, and keep me in control.
That's fantastic stuff, Sid. Thanks so much for that.
My pleasure.
That was Sid Lowe and Guy Hahn. Well, that's about it for part two. Coming up in part three, we're going to have lots more with Italian, German and Scottish football. And indeed your posts. If you want to leave messages for us, go to the Football Weekly page, which can be found at guardian.co.uk/football, or you can go to our Facebook page. Well, welcome back to part three of Football Weekly. I'm here with Kevin McCarr, Raphael Honigstein and Paul Doyle. I'm Ken, already sitting in for James, who is skiing. Kevin, you had the weekend off, and recreationally, you managed to fit in an Old Firm game. This was a nil-nil. Was it a classic of the genre?
I actually went to see my in-laws, and the chocolate cake was marvellous, by the way. But it was an awful game. Celtic missed an open goal, and the Celtic goalkeeper made a couple of really good saves, which stopped Rangers from winning. The impoverishment of it is staggering. It reflects finance in part. Rangers' parent company are over $700 million in debt. Celtic are fine financially, but they're operating by quite sensibly balancing their books. And that means, you know, no more highly paid superstars, you know, of the Henrik Larsson variety, even if such a person could be persuaded to come to Glasgow, which I think is unlikely.
They, according to Peter Lowell, they're going to go down the Arsenal route, the ever fashionable Arsenal route, which doesn't really seem to have worked all that well for Arsenal, if we look at what's happened to them over the last few years.
Well, they don't have any option. You either buy kind of bargain basement players who you hope will come good for you, or you try the youth thing. Peter Lowell's a very clever, capable, personable man, but he's operating according to the guidelines he's given by the board, which, as I say, is quite prudently, don't lose too much money. We can't go on losing money. Celtic had two or three share issues because they kept on running into debt under the exciting times of Martin O'Neill. Not Martin's fault. He asked for money and they gave it to him. And then share issues were required to make good the deficit. Rangers, of course, the same story. Only have to go further back to the days of Loudrup and Gascoigne. Well, players like that, again, wouldn't come to Scotland now, but also Rangers couldn't afford them.
Football Weekly listeners will know that usually at this point we'll have a very detailed roundup of the weekend's action in Serie A. Unfortunately, James is away and Paolo is in Dubai. Luckily for us all, however, BBC Three decided to screen this match, AC Milan against Inter Milan. Inter won 2-1.
I mean, don't you think it's a great way to spend our taxpayers' money, the license fee?
I suppose it depends on how much it costs. I mean, was it a good way to spend 90 minutes of your time?
Well, David Beckham made sure we got value because even when he was substituted, he ostentatiously caressed his injured limb in front of the cameras rather than going into the dressing room as other people would have done.
Further emphasising his now uselessness to the LA Galaxy.
One use he has to the Galaxy is a huge cash cow. Now they stand to make a lot of money if Milan pay the fee that they seek.
Yeah, we don't obviously want to get bogged down in discussing David Beckham here. I mean, the football is maybe a bit more important. But Kevin, you were saying that that Beckham maybe stands to lose quite a bit of money if he succeeds in pushing through this deal.
Well, certainly people in the MLS say that the various contracts attached to his time at LA Galaxy are so immense that nothing could compare with them, and that it is if he does it, it's a genuine altruistic desire to play football at a higher level. But equally, LA Galaxy are not going to give him to Milan. I think Milan think, well, the MLS isn't serious, we'll give him a few quid and he'll give us Beckham. They've now found out different. I think LA Galaxy do have a figure like £15 million in mind, which is extraordinary for a 31-year-old football player.
What did you make of the game, Raphael? Was this Jose Mourinho before the game was saying people in England need to watch more Italian football. People who are in love with the game understand Italian football is a game that you play with your brain, not all this running around. Was this an evidence of the cerebral quality of the play?
He's changing his tunes all the time, isn't he? Because sometimes he says Italian football is really bad. They don't understand me, or they don't really know how good I am.
Yeah, when he arrived in the summer, it was Italian football is unpopular around the world. I'm going to help you change that.
Well, I mean, the game certainly did help in that that sense because it was a great game. I mean, I'm perhaps an Italophile and always enjoy these occasions, but the football was really, really good. And I think it was good because Inter have been sort of amusingly dysfunctional for quite a while. I mean, they're not really good at defending at all. You constantly wonder what sort of system they're actually playing. I'm not sure Mourinho and his players on the same wavelength for, but they have great players and they're always liable to score spectacular goals. And exactly what happened. And after they were 2-0 up, a normal or, you know, your stereotypical Italian game would have been over. But Inter kept, for some reason, going forward. They left huge gaps at the back, and Milan really went for it, and they nearly equalised. They had a goal ruled off. Inzaghi, I think, was offside 15 times in the last 10 minutes. Nearly scored, though, and they really pushed them all away. And they only came alive, I'm afraid I have to say, once Beckham went off, because he'd done absolutely nothing.
Well, there was also a hat-trick by Adrian Mutu for Fiorentina against Genoa, which seemed to be actually the most exciting game of the weekend. It was 3-3 there from a 3-0 position. But we also wanted to discuss what happened in Germany, Raphael, where the leaders keep losing, and in this case, rather spectacularly.
Yeah, well, Hoffenheim, people have been waiting for the crash or for the bubble to burst, and it's slowly... they're being slowly deflated, I think. They're slowly sort of suffering from an accumulation of things.
I mean, 4-1 against Leverkusen, yeah, is actually rather rapid deflation.
I mean, Leverkusen were brilliant. They really took them apart. They also scored after 2 minutes, then just before halftime, and then just after halftime. So, you know, I think if you're a Hoffenheim player, you just think, okay, thanks. You know, this is not our day today, or not our night. But they were very good. And then, but even more surprisingly, was Hertha. Beating Bayern. Now Hertha are now at the top of the table, which is unbelievable. Not only because before the season people thought, you know, they'd do really well if they finished maybe top 10, maybe top 8. That'd be a great result. They have very little cash. They showed no sign of being really very much improved last season. And to give you an indication of just how surprising it is, they've never actually been top of the Bundesliga in the second half of the season ever.
Right.
And I think this must be maybe their 30th season in the top flight. So it really is unbelievable. And I still, if you ask me why are they top, I still couldn't really give you an answer.
Well, what about one reason being Andre Varenin's stunning double?
Yeah,
against Bayern.
He's been playing really well. And actually Hertha have been trying to talk him and Liverpool and making the move permanent. The problem is they can't really afford his wages. And I don't think Liverpool are keen on letting him go for free or for very little money. They want to recoup some of the money. So it's a bit of a shame, because I think, well, maybe it would be unkind to say he's found his level, but certainly he benefits from playing week in, week out. And they're playing a counter-attacking football, which seems to suit him fine. It really reminds me a bit of when you used to see good Ukraine games with him and Shevchenko playing a lot on the counter, and that's exactly what's happening now for Hertha.
Finally, Rafael Martignol, the long yearn for fulfillment is at hand.
For him or for Hamburg?
For him and for Hamburg.
Yeah, for Spurs fans. He's doing really well. I mean, they won a game against Bielefeld. It wasn't easy. But, you know, they're really playing good football. There is a big, big sort of almost a Liverpool-type expectation at Hamburg to finally get back to where they were and rightfully belong in their own eyes. And you know, it's been over 20 years since they won the title there. So just the fact that he keeps them in the running is reflects really well on him. And you know, they've been selling good players before the season. They've been selling again in the winter break. Yet still, he finds solutions and he finds selections that perform decent performances. They had a big setback last week where they lost to Karlsruhe after being 2-0 up. They lost 3-2. But Frank Rost, one of the most critical players in the Bundesliga, their keeper, came out and said, you know, there is a momentum building here. And if we can get into the Champions League, or if we perhaps come and get into a final in one of the cup competitions, it'll be a big step up for Hamburg. And there is that sense of optimism around the place since he's come.
Do you remember Martignol as a player, Kevin?
No.
Anyone remember this?
Well, he was at Bayern for 1 year, but that was one of the worst years in the 70s. I mean, the one few years where they didn't win anything, and then he left back. It went back again. So,
has there ever been a big clamour among the Hamburg faithful for Kevin Keegan to be manager?
Strangely, no. No.
It's just some of the posts on the last podcast are all about this issue of whether great players make great managers, right. You know. Most of the
opinion seeming to lean to, no, if you're a good player, you're probably not going to be that good a manager. Just one of the posts here was from Ooh Roger Palmer. Just making points. Managers require skills that involve tactics, human resource skills, negotiations, and even public relations. Great footballers need to be fit and talented. These are by no means diametrically opposed positions, but there's a lot to be said that people who view the game from distance and experience lots of styles and formations may be better suited to management than a footballer who rarely gets to see a match from a decent viewpoint for their entire career.
Well, so I think
journalists then sound like the ideal manager.
Has there actually been a great journalist turned manager?
Pap Diouf at Marseille was a...
But he's kind of more of a journalist turned deal maker, is he not?
Like Sahavi, yeah. Sahavi. An inspiration to all of us.
Saki Saki was never a journalist.
Saki was a shoe salesman, I think.
Yes, he was, yeah.
I think that the point about great managers is, and great players is, you know, when people say, oh, great players, then most of them don't become great managers. Well, the thing is, it's incredibly difficult to win things as a manager and as a player. So if you've won big things, to do it again is very, very difficult. And if you don't, then you say, it's typical. Great manager again doesn't do anything. So, you know, you could find plenty of great big names who've done very well as well, but you just tend to forget them. You know, the Beckenbauers, Magaths.
Surely Fabio Capello's a tremendous example. Exactly. Somebody's had a great career in both sides of the divide.
Trapattoni. Dalglish.
Well, that's actually one final thing, Kevin. Kenny Dalglish seems to be able to spot a player, always used to. Is that a quality which decays with age, with time out of the game? Because I've always wondered why it is he seems so reluctant to get back into management since the Celtic episode.
Well, yeah, I mean, but then he was director of football at Celtic. I don't know how much he had to do with signings, but the signings worked out very, very badly. And it's funny how judgment doesn't seem to be guaranteed, because he bought brilliantly for Liverpool and Blackburn. But maybe, of course, it's harder to get the players he wanted to come to Celtic.
Well, I suppose with that, I'm going to thank you, Kevin McCarr, Chief of Player of The Guardian, Raphael Honigstein of the Süddeutsche Zeitung, and also Paul Doyle of The Guardian.
Thanks, Ken.
Thanks a million for coming in, folks, and thanks to you for listening. That was Football Weekly, and we'll speak to you again on Thursday.